Network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to The Child of Gulag with Dr. Yuri C. Feinberg. Dr. Feinberg has a unique perspective on issues facing our country and world today. Having been a former citizen of the Soviet Union and a political refugee since 1979, how are the issues we face tied to the not-so-distant past, and how will they affect our coming future? Now, here is your host, Dr. Yuri Feinberg.
Hello, world. This is Dr. Yuri Feinberg, also known as the Child of Gulag. And the name is, for those who don't know, is because I grew up in the Gulag, which is Soviet penal system, and I also wrote a book about my unusual childhood. We have a very interesting show today. I'm going to start the show with reading a page or so from my book, where I deal with the issue that we will explore later on in depth with Dr. Andrew Lane, who is a professor at Columbia University. I will do a full introduction of Dr. Lane when he joins us. But for now, I'm going to give you a brief intro into what I'm going to read. It's about my childhood, and I grew up in the Siberian labor camp because my mother was working there as a doctor. And there were several events. One especially, the death of my beloved teacher, professor, who was tutoring me. There was no school. I was the only child, so I had private tutoring, so to speak. And he died. And he died because there were no medications to treat him. It was a tough time after World War II, in the beginning of the 50s, and I'm going to read you a page which will bring you into the world of that time. To preface it, I would say that I was going to go see him for my regular lesson, and my mother, who was treating him, she told me, and I'm reading now, "He's not well. I have been visiting him every evening for the past 2 weeks. He has an advanced stage of pneumonia. Why doesn't anyone tell me anything? Why?" Yul, and that's the name I use, knew what pneumonia meant. He witnessed too many deaths as a result of it, where the majority of the victims died of what was called Chakotka. It's an old-fashioned Russian word condition. Although penicillin was mass-produced in the United States, especially at the end of World War II, it did not make its way all the way to the Gulag. Occasional single doses were used primarily to treat the prison guards and their families. "I am going to see him anyway," said Yu. Zoya, that's my mother's name, looked at him and realized that there was no way she should be able to stop her son. The stubbornness must have been painted visibly on his face. "Just don't torture him with your questions. He's very weak," she said. "He's also very anemic. He also has leukemia. Can't you cure him? At least his pneumonia. If I had enough penicillin, that is, but I have depleted all of my supplies, and the next shipment is not due until the spring. He also needs a blood transfusion, which is out of the question." They looked at each other, neither said a word, but both knew the inevitable outcome. It was just a matter of time. Ivan Lensky was in bed. He looked unnaturally pale and had huge dark blue and black shadows around his eyes. The book he was reading before Yul walked in was lying on his chest with the cover facing up. Anton Pavlovich Chekhov, Short Stories. "How are you?" asked Yul. It was a silly question, and Yul knew it, but the awkwardness of the moment demanded something to be said. It was the best he could have come up with. "Как дела?" "Just like you see." "I see you're reading Chekhov." "Yes, he's my favorite. Very few writers know the Russian character as well as Chekhov." "But there are millions of people in Russia. They can't have the same character. You are right and wrong at the same time. Individually, we're different from one another, but collectively, we have a common denominator. This common denominator has been developed over centuries in Russian history and has become a part of our genes. For instance, Chekhov calls the Russian peasant lazy because during long and harsh winters, there is nothing else to do but to drink, sleep, and drink again. But come spring, the same mujik, the peasant, works like hell to provide for the next winter. You see, that is why..." He didn't finish the sentence. He covered his mouth with a towel, and a long coughing spell shook his entire body for half a minute. After it was over, the towel was covered with red spots. Professor put his head on the pillow and looked at Yul apologetically. "I will come back tomorrow," said Yul. "No, no, no, stay with me." "I don't know how long." The words hung in the air. There was no need to continue the sentence. "Would you like me to read for you?" asked Yul. "I would love it. Here's the story. It's called In a Strange Land." Yul started to read, but soon stopped. Ivan Lansky had his eyes closed. But as soon as the reading stopped, he looked at Yul quizzically. "You need to rest," Yul said. "I will get plenty of rest when I'm gone. Resting in peace, so to speak. But if you really have to go, I will see you tomorrow." All right, well, I read a little more than I intended to, because it brings the memories back, and I can't help but being emotional. But my next question will be to Professor Lane, who is, like I said, the professor at Columbia University. He's a chair of the Department of Biomedical Engineering. He's a professor of radiology physics in the Department of Radiology. And he's also director of Hefner Biomedical Imaging Laboratory. He had written more than 200 papers on the subject, and his interest varies so much that I'm looking at two pages of his work, and I'm, like I told him before the show, it probably will take the entire segment to list them, which I'm not going to do. But you can tell that he's a well-renowned, one of the best in his area. And I would like to introduce Dr. Lane. Hello, Dr. Lane.
Hi, Yuri. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I really appreciate taking time out of your busy schedule and to do the show with me. Well, you just heard this little excerpt from my book, and obviously nobody knows more than you do of the progress that took place in the world in the last, obviously 60 years since this event took place that I just described. And I would like you to briefly just to do a brief observation of what had happened over that period of time, since people were dying left and right, because once you get TB or just pneumonia, you're gone.
Back then, in the availability of penicillin, which certainly would have helped prevent a lot of deaths, was not widely produced. It wasn't until the, 1943 or so, between 41 and 43, 19, that, you know, the ability to produce large quantities of penicillin and distribute them in the battlefields going on in World War II, that, you know, such a wonder drug as penicillin, was had. And, you know, it turns out that actually the British actually were stretched financially to advance the research scientists. I think it was at Oxford University back then. And then in collaboration with the U.S., they figured out a formula to inject air and to increase the volumes of yields of penicillin by a factor of 10. And so later in the war, the drug got an opportunity to prove itself as a lifesaver, but in Russia at that time, unfortunately, the delivery of penicillin did not make it to the soldiers in Russia. And so...
Let alone 6,000 miles away from the World War II battlefields that usually that took place between Ural Mountains and Western Europe, but behind Ural Mountains, which is another 4,000 miles going towards Vladivostok and towards Japan, basically, that terrain is, it was like a completely impassable at that time. And like I read the paragraph, the supplies were not coming. Even in the late 40s and early 50s, there were no supplies of antibiotics going to that part of the world. So,
yeah, and it was, you know, in the, if you look back even in the American Civil War, you know, wounds that were gangrene or some bacterial infection took place, the best therapy was to, you know, cut off a limb or an arm was the only real fix. So penicillin was a game changer, and certainly one of the first quote wonder drugs to emerge in the, you know, in the history of antibiotics.
Well, which brings me to the next question, which is much closer to your field of expertise, which is the research, because I would like you to tell the listeners, just to give us an overview of your current research. What are you involved in?
Well, you know, my roots, I'm in the field of biomedical engineering, but I didn't start out that way. I was trained as an applied mathematician and a computer scientist. But I've always had a love of medicine. And so when I got my first faculty position, which was at the University of Florida in Gainesville, I sought out the chair of the radiology department there, whose name was Ed Staub. And he got me involved looking at breast cancer back then. This was in the early 1990s. And this also ties to the history of the Soviet Union in the sense that when Gorbachev, you know, reduced the size of the Soviet Union, the U.S. found itself with a lot of redundancies and military bases in Europe. And by the early 1990s, the Defense Department had a lot of extra money in its coffers, and so there was a outcry of women in the military who were, you know, dying of breast cancer, and they said, hey, come on, we need to solve this disease. And the U.S. Army Medical Materiel Command, which is based in Maryland, put out a call for proposals to look into ways of early detection of breast cancer, because it was very well known that if you could detect the breast cancer, for example, a lump, if it was less than a centimeter in diameter, there was in fact a 95% cure rate. And so with that focus in mind, I launched my career in medical imaging. And I mentioned that I was a mathematician, or applied mathematician, that was dealing with an area of harmonic analysis called wavelet theory. And this is a way of simply breaking down harmonics into fundamental components, but doing so in a non-destructive way so that you could tease out the signals or the composition of an image in a very non-destructive way. And for example, I don't know if you're familiar with an audio system, a graphical equalizer that allows you to, let's say, increase the lower frequencies corresponding, let's say, a bass drum in terms of harmonics, and or you could enhance the middle frequencies of a voice, say, 1200 hertz.
Well, I actually know it from my daughter, who is studying music technology at NYU. She educated me on this subject, so yeah.
So much in the same way, you can decompose, one-dimensional music into its various harmonics. You can do the same thing with an image. And so what we did was we took, for example, microcalcifications are one type of finding that doesn't mean you have breast cancer, but it's a clue that perhaps there might be an indication of breast cancer. And those typically appear in a radiograph as white little speckles or dots. And that would correspond to, in terms of harmonics, a high frequency occurrence within a signal. Whereas a mass or a sort of a lower frequency harmonic in terms of an image would be the occurrence of a large mass. Let's say a centimeter inside would be something very low in frequency. And so this tool that we developed allowed us to interactively decompose a very complex mammogram into three areas, the third being a spicular type lesion, which was a linear type of feature that would amass in a foci of around the center of a lesion, sort of a locus type of focus.
Wow, it's fascinating. We are coming to a break. Hold that thought. I have like 10 questions already on my mind to ask you. I mean, I'm absolutely fascinated by what you just said. All right, we're going on a break, and I'm going to come back. I'm going to continue interview with Dr. Lane on the Child of Gulag show. Please stay with us.
Stay connected. Sign up for our newsletter. Go beyond your favorite Voice America shows. Visit iradioblog.com.
If you have a loved one that is undergoing treatment for substance abuse or mental illness, you owe it to them and yourself to tune in to One Hour at a Time with host Mary Woods. This compassionate and educational talk show will help you help those that you love by better understanding their condition and their personal recovery process. Tune in every Monday at 12 noon Pacific time to One Hour at a Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Recovery begins this hour.
Do you know that over 70% of Americans with severe disabilities are unemployed? Are you one of the 2.5 million Americans with epilepsy? If you are, or know someone struggling with these issues, tune in to Disability Matters with Joyce Bender. On the show, Joyce will discuss these issues as well as others. She will have on nationally known guests that will offer helpful insight on disability matters and let you, the listener, call in with your questions and concerns. So if you struggle with a disability or know someone who does, listen to Disability Matters with Joyce Bender. Heard every Tuesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time here on VoiceAmerica.com.
Your favorite Voice America Talk Radio Network shows and hosts are in your car, outdoors, and wherever you need them to be. Listen anywhere. Get our mobile app for iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android at the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market. You are listening to The Child of Gulag with Dr. Uri C. Feinberg. We invite you to participate in the discussion on our show. Please call 1-866-472-5788 during the live program. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send an email to ycf@lifeadjustmentcenter.com. Now, back to The Child of Gulag.
We're back with Dr. Andrew Lane. professor at Columbia University, and we're discussing a fascinating subject of his current research. And Andrew, please finish the description.
Sure. So imagine if an image could sort of talk to you and make harmonic sounds. The ability of a wavelet decomposition allowed us to tease out these salient features within a mammogram and allowed radiologists to detect breast cancer at a much earlier stage. It turns out that the reason why most radiologists were missing a lesion retrospectively was because they just didn't see it. And so the tool that we developed, eventually what happened was, tying this back to the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was a call for a workshop at which I was invited, and I made a presentation to a group of people who I didn't really appreciate who they were, but it turned out in the audience were the top medical doctors in breast cancer research from MGH in Boston and UCLA that had been studying the problem for many years. And I made the presentation and I showed by using wavelet analysis you could enhance the image to make it more or less a no-brainer in detecting these very previously difficult findings of a radiograph. And so what happened was after that workshop, I got a call from the director and said, of all the talks, we felt that your technology was the most promising in terms of having a impact in actually reducing breast cancer. And we would encourage you to submit a proposal to the NIH on that, not to the NIH, to the U.S. Army Military Materiel Command. And so who had the funds again, just to remind you, there was a surplus of funding.
Because of the collapse of Soviet Union.
Yeah. And it was those funds that actually launched my career in the field of medical imaging. So that really ties in with what you with the history of the Soviet Union in that sense.
I have a follow up question, just out of curiosity. Why do you think this problem was originated in the United States Army, but not in the community at large? Is that because the prevalence of breast cancer among women in the Army was like greater, or what is the reason?
In my understanding. The women were complaining, and maybe rightfully so, that a lot of the attention was given to testicular cancer, and that women really were neglected in that sense. The same thing with heart disease, that even though women also die of heart disease, that most of the medications and most of the thrust of research directive were primarily focused on men. And so, the Army, it just so happens, had a very vocal group of women at that time that that said, come on, enough's enough. If there are resources available, let's see if we can do a better job on women's diseases.
Someone can say, because they've been exposed to some kind of radiation or combat or whatever situation was there that actually made the breast cancer more prevalent.
Yeah, there could be that tie.
Yeah.
I have not any statistics on that, but certainly, I know my own uncle, his wife died of cancer, and he was tied to the military with Strategic Air Command.
Mm-hmm.
We always thought, but no one could ever prove it. But there is a risk factor of the military that are certainly exposed to chemical weapons and other types of. Possible.
I guess we'll never know. It will be another Area 57, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. I have a specific question which I'm personally very interested in. It's the lung diseases. Although my mother, who was, like I said, she was a doctor in Siberia, she was specializing in lung diseases in a primitive way that she could have, helped the people. But I would like you, Andrew, to specifically talk about the lung diseases in your research.
Yeah. So lung disease, specifically what's called COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, You may have heard advertisements on the TV about this, about drugs to treat this.
Right.
It is now the third largest cause of death in the U.S. and soon to be the world. It's really overtaking heart disease. And the reality of it is, there was a latest paper published this month in Lancet stating that nobody really understands this disease. And so at Columbia, I'm working with colleagues such as Graham Barr and others trying to develop methods that could assess and do a better job at classifying the variations of COPD, which could be bronchitis, it could be emphysema. But the reality of it is, even if you have, you know, the most seasoned radiologists that specialize in diagnosing lung disease, which we have at Columbia, we have, you know, some of the best people here in the country probably. And if you ask two or three of them to classify a disease related to the lung, the variation among those expert physicians can be as high as, you know, 35% or more, which is a tremendous variability in being able to follow a particular, you know, therapy in order to treat the disease. And so in my research, we're trying to exploit what's called longitudinal data. And the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, has been sponsoring a longitudinal study where patients are tracked over, let's say, an 8 to 12 year period. And every few years they come in and they receive a CT scan of their chest, as well as an MRI of their heart, because there's a contention that perhaps lung disease and heart disease are correlated in the sense that if your lungs sort of offer more pushback or sort of a resistance to the blood, that that can effectively strain the heart. It can cause a certain amount of heart failure to complement. So there's a open issue whether heart disease is preceded by lung disease or not. That's an open question of research. But we've been looking at you know, patients that we have over the last 8 years, you know, four data points on them, and trying to look at the outcome of these patients as they've been treated for various types of lung disease. And you know, this type of approach is not only used in lung disease, but it's something that the you know, the NIH believes is the way of the future in what's called effective medicine, where you look at the statistics of previous outcomes, and by looking at those statistics, you would be able to predict if a new patient exhibited a certain number of symptoms that would fit the sort of average patient, that they would enable the clinician to make a more intelligent pathway to ensure a better outcome for that particular patient.
Are there some COPDs that were deemed completely incurable, as opposed to some that relatively easy to cure? Have been any classifications put forward for?
Well, there is no cure. I mean, right now
there is no. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a disease that if you have seen patients that have advanced stages, the chest will become very large. It'll sort of elongate because the lungs are trying to you know, to grow, certainly to make up for the lack of the alveoli in the lung to mm-hmm. to do its job and collect oxygen. So, you know, there are treatments where you can minimize and improve quality of life. But right now we're hoping by doing the research that we're doing, which is looking at the models of airways combined with the various textures. So if you look at an image in 3D, the structure of the lung is like a sponge, and well, it's a very structured sponge, but there are little holes and there are little pockets there, and it exhibits from a morphological point of view of an image a texture, And so we're looking at ways of characterizing, let's say, an emphysema-type texture versus a bronchitis-type texture, and being able to classify the diseases based on what's called superhuman classification. So, you know, as humans, you know, our visual systems are very good, but it's possible with computer technology to do a super job in seeing dimensions and seeing correlates of these different textures. If you look at it in terms of tying it back to the wavelet theory, the harmonics of a texture is the variations in contrast, local contrast fluctuations in grade level and intensities around a region of the lung. And so that's sort of an expression of a signature that can be used to classify one of these diseases. The hope is that if we can do a better job at classifying the diseases, we can then understand the physiology and the mechanisms by which those diseases originate and treat them better.
Now, but the causes could be different. It's not like you contract a common cold and then it becomes pneumonia and then it becomes COPD. It's not the case, right?
Right, yeah.
It could come in variety of reasons and shapes and forms, right?
Yes, absolutely. There are, along with this study that the NIH is doing to better understand that, there's an air pollution component involved that several cities in the U.S. are gathering data regarding the quality of air. So there are environmental factors that come into play. There are, you know, genetic factors that come into play in terms of susceptibility. And so all of these things are very complex questions that need to be modeled and understood before we really understand the dynamics and the origins of this disease. But it's a big one. It's a sleeping giant.
Well, I mentioned at the beginning of the interview that I have a special interest for many reasons. One, that I witnessed the death of my teacher from this. And then when I was a teenager, I had a TB, and I didn't know that until I arrived at the United States in 1979. When I had my first x-ray, the doctors gathered around me, asked me, what happened to you? And I said, I have no idea what happened. What do you mean? My lungs are scarred because I had an open tuberculosis, and I didn't know that. But I guess my immune system, and I was healthy enough to just overcome it without any knowledge and without any medications.
Yes. Yeah, this is along the same lines. The technology of those x-rays or the CT, a computed tomography, which is nothing more than a three-dimensional x-ray of the lung, as the technology has improved, and especially in the last decade or so, what's happening is radiologists are increasingly seeing a finding of the lung that, you know, 20 years ago, if you had a finding, the threshold of detection was not as good. And so the protocol required, if you had a finding, that you should follow up on that finding. And so there's an active, not debate, but there's an issue of coming into terms with a finding that the immune system could naturally suppress. I mean, we all, if you take a CT off the street of anybody, you're gonna see little findings, little bumps and sort of irregularities in the lung, little microinfections that may appear as a cancer, but in reality, you're 100% right. If the person's immune system is sufficient, they'll knock those things down and suppress them on their own. They don't need to have a surgery or have a follow up at all.
It's interesting because when my radiologist told me that, and I started thinking back, and I did remember that my stepbrother, whom I lived with, had TB that he was treated because he was discovered, and I had no idea. I guess I was healthier than he was. He had a lot of symptoms, and I didn't, except for running a very light fever for a couple of weeks and waking up drenched in sweat. But, you know, when you're 15, 16, who pays attention to this stuff? And then slowly and surely it went away. And yeah. So yeah. Those were my symptoms. That's why I didn't complain. That's why I didn't have an x-ray done, because I didn't have a need for that. I said, oh, well, look, I'm just tired, you know. But, you know, there's nothing like being 16 and healthy, right?
That's right, yeah. Just a strong man.
Yeah.
Fight back.
Yeah. Well, and there's another disease that you and I briefly discussed before the show, which I would like to touch on. It's macular degeneration. I know that you've done some research on that as well. So can you just briefly tell us?
Yeah, the adult macular degeneration is the loss of vision in the retina, and this is another disease where it's really not understood well, both its origins and its diagnosis. And so we're involved with, we're actually collaborating with Dr. Theodore Smith at New York University, NYU, on a grant that is looking at what's called hyperspectral image analysis, where we look at the reflection of plaques that come into play at various stages of macular degeneration. And we're trying to understand the composition of these plaques and how that relates to both treatment and patient outcome. And so this is an active area of research where, we don't know anything. We know very little about how to treat this type of disease and how to cure it for sure. There is no cure per se. So we're actively engaged with looking at ways of classifying the plaque to see correlate, for example, it's been correlated that certain types of plaque are related to two particular genomes that were discovered at Columbia, and so there could be a genetic susceptibility for patients that would be nice to alert them.
Well, Andrew, you're clearly on the cutting edge of the medical evolution because you're dealing with things that have not been cured so far. I mean, you just listed things and like there's no cure.
Yeah,
the world is looking at you.
Well, I have good students in my lab to help me. So.
That is so wonderful, and you know, I'm so honored to call you my friend because this is absolutely magnificent what you're doing. Okay. All right, well, we're coming to a break, and we're going to continue after the break with the Child of Gulag Show and Dr. Andrew Lane. Stay with us.
Be sure to friend us on Facebook. You can do it right now. Visit facebook.com/Voice America or search for us at keyword Voice America.
Think of the world 50 years ago. Now think of this same world and how it'll be 50 years from now. Did you know that if the world's population continues to grow at its current rate, our children and grandchildren will only have 25% of the resources per capita that our parents and grandparents had? We must preserve the foundation of a quality standard of living. That foundation starts with Go Green Radio. Join your host, Jill Buck, for Go Green Radio every Friday at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on Voice America.
Listen for Trust Across America every week on the Voice America Variety Channel. Tune in as host Jordan Kimmel is joined by national experts in the fields of accounting, finance, organizational behavior, and sustainability, as well as companies that are applying strategies that are enabling them to be recognized as doing the right thing by the American Trust Awards. Your host, Jordan Kimmel, is himself a trusted professional with years of experience in applying strategies and consulting with today's leading firms. Trust Across America is heard Wednesdays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on Voice America Variety.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
You are listening to The Child of Gulag with Dr. Uri C. Feinberg. We invite you to participate in the discussion on our show. Please call 1-866-472-5788 during the live program. That's 1-866-472-5788. Or send an email to ycf@lifeadjustmentcenter.com. Now, back to the Child of Gulag.
We're back with Dr. Andrew Lane, and we're discussing his research topics. My next question for our guest is the, I'm interested in the overview of the medical imaging field as a whole, because a lot of people heard words and, you know, names like MRI, ultrasound, CT scanning, tomography, the PET imaging, and all of that. And even to me, some of them, I have a vague understanding sometimes of the differences, like subtle differences among those things. So I would like Dr. Lane to enlighten us on these subjects.
Sure. Okay. So maybe the best way to start that is to look at a historical timeline as to when these modalities sort of came online and began to be used in medicine. And certainly the earliest imaging modality is the X-ray, or the Röntgen ray, which was discovered in Germany by Röntgen in 1895. So it's been over 100 years since the X-ray was discovered. And curiously enough, at Columbia University, Dr. Pupin, who was a physicist back then, worked with Edison, Thomas Edison, here in New Jersey. Actually, he turned out that he missed publishing by 2 weeks the discovery of the X-ray. Back in 1895, there was no internet, and so communication bandwidth was very, very small. But they did publish later a film screen radiograph, which is still used in mammography, for example, for focusing the X-ray and allowing a sharper image. And then it wasn't until, that really was the fact that you could see through. You know, prior to that, the only way that a doctor or a medical person would know what's going inside the body was you have to cut it up. You have to open up and see, look inside. And finally, the X-ray was a game changer in the sense that they didn't have to invasively, you know, cut into a body to perhaps make a diagnosis. So that was a huge game changer. In the 1960s, another game changer that came into play was what's called nuclear medicine, the idea of taking a sugar and attaching a radionucleotide to binding to that sugar, for example, with FDG, for example, and then collecting the photons or the X-ray energy as that radioactive material decayed, it would emit a certain amount of radiation, and then collecting that radiation through a colmeter, such that an image could be constructed by what's called a Radon transform, which inverts a linear projection of lines into a two-dimensional image. I'll make a sidebar comment on the Radon transform in a moment, but that was also a game changer in that it allowed physicians to look at the physiology of a disease in terms of a cancer. So, for example, if they could tell, cancers are usually very aggressive in consuming sugars and metabolites in the body as they grow, and they would cause a concentration of this radionucleotide to sort of light up around that area of a hotspot where the physiology in terms of sugar consumption was most active. And that would result in, let's say, a bright spot of the PET image. And then in the 1972, the CT, the X-ray, it was realized that by using a mathematical reconstruction formula called the Radon transform, again, this was a French mathematician, whose method, this algorithm, sat on the shelf for, you know, maybe 80 years or so. But it was realized that through this Radon transform and collecting singular line intensity profiles as a radial ensemble, that you could feed this into the Radon transform and remarkably invert that reconstruction and obtain a two-dimensional image. And that resulted in what's called CT, or computed tomography. Again, this is an X-ray-based imaging modality. Both PET and any X-ray imaging modality, whether it be traditional chest radiographs or a computed tomography image, is considered a type of ionizing or invasive type of imaging because you're ionizing the tissue. You're exposing the human tissue or the DNA to perhaps being altered. There's a low risk of that. That's why you want to minimize the dose of radiation when you screen a patient, and a physician has to balance the value of what that image will tell him or her versus the threat or the risk of causing a cancer 20 years down the road. And this is particularly sensitive in children that may have that concern. One of the
by introducing those radioactive material inside the body.
Exactly. So one of the methods that we were involved with in our research lab when I first came to Columbia was looking at rubidium-82, which is a very quickly decaying radionucleotide. It has a half-life, let's say, 2 minutes before it's gone for the body, but that constrains the imaging acquisition to be extremely sensitive to capturing those weak type of signals and being able to construct a useful image out of it. So we developed denoising techniques that actually improved the signal-to-noise ratio of that very quickly decaying radionucleotide that could be used in children, for example.
Is this technology being used already, or it's in the research stage?
That is being used. That technology is absolutely being used today. Mm-hmm. At least in New York, it is for sure. I know that I developed that in collaboration with an MD PhD student and Steve Bergman, who's still in New York City and one of the premier PET imaging people in the country. But more recently, in ultrasound, which is considered a non-invasive imaging modality, meaning that there's no risk or no threat of damaging one's DNA and causing a cancer, at least at the power levels that's used clinically. And MRI, likewise, it doesn't ionize the tissue, so there's absolutely no risk of getting a cancer, 20 years down the road by having an ultrasound screening or an MRI type of screening. So these modalities have become the most popular today because of their lower risk. And I think what you're going to see in the next decade, particularly ultrasonic types of imaging, 3D and 4D imaging, because it's portable, it's low cost, you're going to see a revolution in ultrasonic imaging. And the revolution in MRI is already undergoing. There's annual conferences in MRI that 20,000 people attend. It's just a huge area of research now.
Oh, I remember when MRI technique was first introduced in this country. It was during my time, actually, after I came to the United States. It was, first of all, it cost a fortune to have the equipment, and then like 10 years down the road, on every corner there was an MRI lab. Advertising privately, all you have to do is pay a few $100 and you get an MRI yourself. Yeah, it's just proliferated so much. Yeah.
The ability to see soft tissues with MRI versus bone with CT is.
It was such a revolutionary thing. All right. I want to switch gears, Andrew, because we have 5 minutes left before the close of the show. You and I had brief discussion and found eerie similarities between the two of us on the like 10,000 miles apart and what happened to both of us in our career in education and science. I would like you to tell our audience about your early years in the University of Florida.
Sure. Yeah, so I had earlier mentioned this the development of wavelet-based methods of image enhancement, which were used for the early detection of mammograms, which are radiographs of the breasts. And so this was in 1992, and back at the University of Florida, there was little incentive to patent these algorithms. And I went to the IP people, the intellectual property people, and I said, this technology, really you should patent it because it's going to have widespread impact and benefit to improving the detection of breast cancer. Now, mind you, in 1992, digital detectors were not available. They are now. Every mammography system now is digital. Back then, they were still using film. So I was perhaps too far ahead of the wave in the sense, and they dismissed me and said, well, you know, we don't want to bother with this. Good luck. And back then, I was an assistant professor. I wasn't tenured. So, of course, I said, well, I'm going to let the cat out of the bag. And I went ahead and I published all of my research results, and I received, you know, accolades from getting grants and papers. But I was a bit disappointed that, you know, the university didn't patent this. Now, from a professional point of view, I know that vendors such as Siemens and GE and others, they hired my PhD students and quickly adopted these methods into their commercial machine. So I get some, you know, degree of satisfaction knowing that the technology is being put to use, but
no credit for that at all, right?
Right. It would have been nice to have a few dollars in my pocket at the same time.
Would be nice, yeah. I mean, but like I said, it's an eerie coincidence, because when you was telling me this, I was brought back to my study during my time at the University of St. Petersburg when I was studying speech pathology, and I was planning to go to research and get my PhD there. My advisor that I was assigned to, a PhD student at the time, directed me to do research in the pediatric clinic, and I was involved in speech pathology at the time, which one of my degrees is in speech pathology, and dyslexia was the subject. So I did a lot of research and a lot of experimentation, you know, dyslexia, the reading, the reverse of the letters, you know, fascinating how the brain works, you know. And then I left. I left the country. And the next thing I knew, that all my research was being used by my advisor, who defended his dissertation, became a doctor, and the bulk of his research was introduced, and it was my research. So I feel the same. But like I told you, I was so magnanimous when I went back, I didn't even punch him out, okay? I just let him be. Yeah, okay. Because I got my PhD in this country, you know. So I shouldn't be complaining, but you know how it works, you know, just amazing.
Yeah.
But you're not a bitter man at all, right? You sort of joke about it lightly.
No, I you know, in a certain sense, I there wasn't a law. The problem was that now there's a law that allows universities to claim the patent rights on federally sponsored grants. And back in 1992, that wasn't the case. So I do understand why the university hesitated to do that, but they, they didn't quite have the vision of doing that. So, but anyway, I do get satisfaction knowing that the technology is perhaps, being put to use to save lives in practice. And so, and my students got good jobs, and I got tenure. I got early tenure, actually, in Florida. So,
you know, like I was going to say, you know what the best revenge is? To be successful. And you definitely are. Okay, so.
Well, thank you. I think you just have to keep punching, as they say.
Absolutely. And you are one of the world's renowned researchers in this area, and you have so many credits that, like I said, it would have taken the entire segment to read them. So, you definitely done well after that little snafu, you know. So, unfortunately, I could talk to you forever, but the show is coming to a close, and I would like to thank my guest, Dr. Andrew Lane, for his time, his busy time, from his duties as a chair and a professor at Columbia University. And if everything will be okay, we're going to invite him back to continue this fascinating discussion.
It would be my pleasure.
Right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Andrew. All right.
Thank you.
All right. All right. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right. We came to the close of the show. This is The Child of Gulag with Dr. Yuri Feinberg. And tune in next time on Voice America Talk Radio Network. Bye-bye.
Thank you for participating in our program this week. please join Dr. Uri C. Feinberg again next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. And have a great week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.